There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I am Matilda Sturridge. When I was 20, I believed that you fell in love, got married, and lived happily ever after. When I was 21, I was pregnant. When I was 22, I was a single parent. This is a podcast about how your expectations of parenthood are often altered by the course of your life. This is Bringing Up Us. Hello and welcome back to Bringing Up Us, the podcast. Today I have the most glorious Tara Carr sat in front of me. Tara, who is the co-founder of School of Comedy, which I was just trying to work out how I explain it. It's like an after school and a holiday club run in West London. It's unbelievable. It kind of teaches kids and gives children the freedom to be funny and to use improvisation and to be inventive. And it's a very good sort of, what's the word? I'm going to say a builder-upper, but that is
confidence.
Yeah, confidence. I was like, builder-upper is a
club.
And it's so, so, so brilliant. And you founded it with Laura Lawson. And there was a TV show. God, I feel like it was around 9 years ago now, 8 years ago.
Yeah.
On Channel 4 called School of Comedy.
It was 10 years ago.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
Which I used to work on and how I met Tara and Laura.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful little creation they have. So if you have children and you live in West London who are ages between
4 and 18 years old,
then do School of Comedy. Is that good? You've also got a show.
We've got a show at the Lyric this very Saturday.
What's your show?
For the little ones aged 4 to 10. And our show is called The Best Bossy Bum Bonkers Party Ever. It's on the Lyric Hammersmith this Saturday.
Tara, we've just been really good at plugging your things. I'm so proud of us. Okay, we're going to get into the podcast because this one, I think, is going to be a really interesting one. This is all about Tara's journey into parenthood, which was, I think, pretty hardcore. Tara.
Hello.
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 Thank you for coming. I'm so excited.
I'm very excited to be here.
So we start each podcast with asking my guest, did you always want to be a parent? And if you did, did you have a sort of expectation of the parent that you wanted to be?
Yes, Matilda, I did always want to be a parent. Literally, probably since the moment I was born, wanted to be a mummy. Played with dollies all the time. It's really obsessed with babies. Couldn't wait to have them. Wanted six of them. Thought I'd probably be very earth mothery. Everyone I've listened to you talk to says the same, don't they?
Yeah, it's so
anyone
true.
Who sort of lives their whole life waiting to be a mother, you imagine you'll be a lot sort of more natural at it.
Yeah, everyone sort of says that. I'm going to be a real earth mother and I'm just going to kind of waft around in my caftans and kind of, you know,
yeah,
kiss and my lovely clean children.
I thought I'd feed them organically and I don't know, but it's slightly different from how I am, for sure.
Really?
I'm quite like how I thought I'd be in terms of, I'm not, I'm like the opposite of a Gina Ford mum.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I thought I'd, and that's how I assumed I'd be.
Yeah.
But it's not as sort of perfect and clean as I thought it would be.
Yeah. Well, I mean.
It's really messy.
I don't think I've exactly met anyone who really is what their expectation was.
No.
Tara, you met Matt when you were 28.
Correct.
Matt, your husband.
My husband.
You got engaged pretty quickly.
We did. We got engaged after 6 months and married within a year.
And you sort of did this because you both knew that you were completely in love with each other, but you also both knew that you were desperate to have children.
Yeah. We just fell madly in love. And we, in fact, I think on the second date, I said that when I saw babies, it made my ovaries twitch. And he said, "That's so sweet. I'd really like to marry you."
That's so
Most men
sweet.
Would run a mile, wouldn't they? No, it's quite sweet.
That's so sweet. So you got married.
We did.
And you just went for it from there, didn't you?
Straight
away. You
started
straight away.
Came off the pill on our honeymoon.
Yeah.
So exciting.
Did you sort of think that you get pregnant quickly? Did you kind of go,
I knew I had polycystic ovaries, and I knew I didn't have them particularly badly, but I did know I was aware that I needed to do it. Someone, like a gynae, had told me in my teens not to go well into my 30s.
Yeah.
That I should try and have and so I was only 29.
Yeah.
So I wasn't really worried. And no one else around me was doing it yet. So it wasn't sort of, but I was just excited.
Yeah. So you were trying for...
So I would say after about 8 months, I mean, to be honest, after about 3 months, I was quite sad.
Mm.
I was like, why hasn't it worked? Like, I'd bought a stick, one of those ovulation sticks, and I thought, oh, I've seen a smiley face, that'll mean I'm pregnant. And then I kept not being pregnant, so it was a bit weird. And you do just sort of become a bit all consumed once you've made the decision and you're actively trying to have a baby.
How quickly did it stop being romantic and exciting, and the fact that you just got married and you were trying for a baby,
yeah,
it was amazing, and sex was exciting because it could lead to this ultimate thing that you've both been dreaming of? And how quickly did sex stop being romantic,
being
and
like
it
that.
Was I'm putting my legs in the air and I'm it's still not working, and,
yeah,
and Matt, you have to be home in an hour because this is my window ovulate, and it was mechanical.
I would say I think after about 8 months, it was definitely on its way to being really stressful,
yeah,
and really bit robotic and a bit, you know, let's, like, we do it because we're making a baby, and it stops being fun. And then maybe after about 15 months, I think I really lost the plot. I felt so sad. And I think I knew deep inside me there was something going on that someone wasn't explaining to me.
And also 15 months is a really long time.
It's a really long time.
For someone who really wants a baby.
Yeah.
It's not, it's a long time to wait.
And other people have got married and have babies or were pregnant already.
So were your friends now starting to kind of do, and you realise that, oh, wait a minute, I've been trying this for a bit.
Yeah.
And okay. And when, what do you do? I mean, when did you go to a doctor?
So as I remember, I went to a doctor maybe 8 months in to one fertility clinic, and he sort of did all the tests. They put dye through your tubes to see whether it goes through, and they look at your ovarian reserve and stuff, and he was like, that you seem to be completely fine and Matt seems to be fine, we'll try you with IUI.
And IUI is
the one where
it's not IVF.
It's not IVF, so it's nowhere near as invasive as IVF. You don't have to have a general anesthetic or anything.
Yeah.
They just scan you and keep an eye on when you're ovulating, and then when you are, they clean the sperm and they put it directly
into your
vagina,
cervix? Inside of your vagina?
Inside of my... Inside of...
So it's... Okay.
So it still has to travel up the tubes to meet the sperm.
The egg?
No. Yes.
The sperm?
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I've got the egg.
Yeah.
Matt's got the sperm. That's right. That's right.
That's why I wasn't working. So that happens. And they kind of said, okay, well, let's try this. See what happens. And then we'll go from there.
Yes.
You try that.
I think we did that, honestly, for about 6 months.
So you were doing that for six... It wasn't just...
I think so, yeah.
God,
I think I did 3 months with Clomid, which is the pill. You can take this pill that makes you ovulate more than one egg.
Right.
Which I don't even think I needed. And then I... And with the IUI. Anyway, I do remember distinctly thinking, Matt was standing in the room and there was a man... You know, a sterile room with my legs in the stirrups, and there was another man inserting Matt's sperm into my vagina.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is so weird. Like, I'm actually fairly newlywed. I've only been in a relationship with him for 18 months at this point. Married for 8 months or something. And how I felt sad. I felt like, oh, this isn't how it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's, I mean, it.
Did Matt feel sad?
I think at that point, yeah, I think probably, I think Matt for the first few years probably felt sad that I felt sad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he was just brilliantly supportive and there. But I, yeah, yeah, I think he probably did feel a bit sad.
Well, that's an incredibly...
But I mean, that was
nothing. Invasive thing.
Yeah, but that was nothing compared to what went
happens.
On. Yeah. I just remember it.
But of course, and that's the beginning. And also in at that time, at that moment, it wasn't what you wanted.
No.
This wasn't how it was meant to be in your head. And yes, although what is to come goes up and up and up. But at that point, it was the first time when you went, something's not quite right.
Yeah.
And why isn't this how I imagined my perfect life to be?
Yes.
And that is always, you know, a really scary point in your life when you go, oh, fuck, but this isn't what I had in mind. Why is this? But this is, that's going to be terrible because this isn't what I had in mind. So you had IUI. You did that for 6 months and you still weren't pregnant.
Still weren't pregnant. Went to a new fertility clinic. We went to the Lister. And the doctor I had there was brilliant. And he said, I'm going to look inside. I'm going to do a hysteroscopy and actually look at your laparoscopy. So hysteroscopy, look at inside your uterus, and a laparoscopy, they look inside your tubes and everything. Mm. And so he did that. And that's supposed to be a kind of 30-minute procedure. And then...
Are you put to sleep?
Go from there. Yeah, just a 30-minute general anaesthetic. Anyway, I didn't come up for like 3.5 hours. And... because when he opened me up, he found that I had had chlamydia that had entirely ruined both my tubes, which weirdly hadn't come up on the dye test that they did. But there was so much scar tissue everywhere and everything was just a mess. And quite shocking. And I do remember that Matt, that is the first time I've ever seen him cry. Because I think at this point, it had probably been 18 months of all this trying to have a baby, and me continually saying there's something wrong and I don't understand why it's not happening. And, you know, constantly saying we have to have sex here and you have to put your balls in ice, cool them down and all this kind of thing. And then suddenly it was found that it's actually never going to happen that way and that the inside of me was ruined from... chlamydia, which I felt such shame and I felt so awful for my poor husband that he'd married this woman that was broken, and it was awful. And anyway, but the doctor said, look, the only way you're ever going to have a baby is through IVF because your tubes definitely don't work. So at least we knew
there was some solace. God, it's so heartbreaking when you say that, but also it's so crazy that I don't even think that I knew about it until not that long ago. And the fact that if you get chlamydia when you're young, if you don't catch it quickly, which is an STD that doesn't really have any signs it can completely ruin a woman.
Annihilate your tube.
I don't think that's even kind of spoken about enough, and why it's just so important.
Yeah.
That everyone just gets themselves checked out.
Yeah.
It's completely, you know,
it's really important.
So important. It's a good sort of reminder that from something that happened when you were younger, fucked you up, Tara.
Yeah.
So when you got that news, which is obviously heartbreaking, was there also a relief in going, okay, right, we have an answer now,
yes,
and this now isn't the way, and we're going to have IVF?
Exactly. And actually, through Matt's tears, what he said is, like, thank God we can do something different because we've been stuck in this rut.
You know,
like, that was driving him mad, this ridiculous, like...
And did it give you a sort of new lease of, great, we're going to have IVF and IVF's going to work?
Exactly, yes. Yeah, it was like once we got over the trauma of the operation and me being a bit green, then it was exciting and we were just going to go and give it a go. So we did, and first time pregnant, amazing. And then we lost the baby at about 13 weeks. Devastated. Do you want me to tell you about the IVF, or do you want me to?
Yeah, no. Go. the only question I did have about the IVF was the drugs you're given with IVF. Did that change you?
Yeah, so IVF is not fun, I would say, but I think everyone deals with it differently. And they basically put you into menopause. So they sort of shut down your ovaries in order to be able to then control all your hormones. Once they're controlling your hormones, it's better. But the first few weeks where they're just shutting everything down, that's really horrible process. Because it just makes you feel so miserable and down and a little bit suicidal. But
are you given support? Do you have, are you told that this is going to happen and not to be frightened? And if there's anyone, do they say come and
they don't
have
really
a therapist?
Say that. The doctors are very practical on that front, but they do offer, or certainly at the Lister, I don't know what it's like at other clinics, but they have an in-house counsellor that you can go to at any point that comes with the service. So you could go 3 times a week if you want, or you go every day, or you could just see her once. And I did see her, and she did explain all of that to me.
So it wasn't a shock. So did you feel prepared for it?
Well, I didn't feel prepared. Because I don't think I saw her until I was in it. But I was in it feeling like it, then I went to see her. And she sat me down and was like, this is completely normal. People in, I think, Scandinavia, the rates of IVF, like they do it once and then they do not do it again, whether they've had the fortunate luck of having a baby or not, because the stress of it's so extraordinary.
You lost a baby at 13 weeks.
Yeah.
Did you immediately try again?
Immediately. I think the doctor said you have to have 1 month. I had to bleed, and then I had to have a period, and then I could try again. I had a frozen one, so I did it straight away, a frozen round, and I was pregnant immediately, and I was so happy, and then literally started bleeding pretty much immediately. They were like, no, it's fine, you're pregnant. And then I kept being pregnant, and then at 6 weeks, I just miscarried it. And I think, so then that happened, 2, 3, 4. So I had 2 more frozen rounds, and it happened again and again. And then I had a fresh round of IVF. That's 4 miscarriages down.
So when you're on your 4th miscarriage, is the doctor still being positive?
Well, the doctor was really strangely positive, and actually sort of, he always said, I think because I was quite young, and I think probably a lot of people doing IVF are in their late 30s, early 40s. And because I started when I was 31 IVF. So at this point, I was only 32 maybe, or 31 even. And he was saying, look, you can go as many times as financially and emotionally you can cope with it, because you've got eggs and you've got a womb. And Matt's got sperm. I don't see why we should stop.
How were you emotionally at that point?
I don't think I ever gave myself a second to process any of it, because I was so determined to get a baby. I heard someone talking the other day, and they said, it's taken us 6 years to get the sibling for their child because I've had 2 miscarriages. And I thought, wow, that's a really long time. But she said she said it in such a way like, I've had to process the feelings. And I thought, that's something I definitely didn't do at the time. Because my main feeling was, I have to get a baby.
How many people around you were getting a baby at this point?
At this point, everyone was at it.
How are you coping with that?
Well, you knew me, Matilda. And do you know what? I think, look, sadly, and I think most people who've ever had fertility problems will say the same, other people's joyous news of pregnancy is some of the worst bits of your own infertility journey. And it's so sad because all you want is to be happy for other people and to share in the joy. That's all anyone wants in their life, isn't it? To be feel happy and be able to be happy for others. But when you're not getting pregnant and people around you are, and it's so easy, it just hurts so much.
Did you, before we go on to talking about the next bit, did you talk to people about how, like you said, did you go to people and say, I can't cope with this kind of stuff at the moment, and this is how I can cope?
Yeah, well, do you know what I think I did? I wouldn't tell the pregnant people that. Look, I was very nice and very probably over the top, even, because it really excites me, babies and all that kind of thing. I've got this really good friend who went through a similar sort of process, and she said every time people told her she was pregnant, she would hand paint cards, like the most over the top, like really go overboard, just to. And I get it. It's like, yeah, I would be really there for people. But I would say maybe to the person who wasn't pregnant at that time, I'd be like, God, I'm sorry, I'm just really struggling being around so-and-so because, of course, they're pregnant and I want to be kind and lovely, but it's just really hard. But then when that person would then get pregnant, they would do exactly the same.
Yeah.
Because they're in their own world and it's fine. And actually, of course, it's fine. And I did, you know, I kept all my friends and I was there for all the babies and I loved it and it was lovely. And people just do things from their own. It's fine. It was just hard.
Yeah, incredibly hard.
Yeah.
But go number five.
Go number five
was
baby Zebby. And he was the first baby born in the country by the process that I think is now called PGD again, but it was called CGH, where they basically, they're so clever, they put a pinprick in the embryo on day three in the placenta.
Oh my God.
Of this tiny, you know, it's only like the size of a tiny pinprick itself.
Tara's currently trying to show me with her fingers how tiny it was.
And they put a pinprick in the placenta, and then on day five, some cells have popped out of the placenta, and they cut them off. They send them to a place in Oxford that then tests if it's got matching chromosomes.
Oh my God.
Is it 23 pairs? I think it's 23. Pairs of chromosomes, so it's 22 pairs, and then it's your X and X or your X and Y, which is the gender.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wait, I feel like I did know something like this, but I didn't know that's oh my
so
gosh.
An embryo can exist outside of the womb for up to 6 days maximum.
Yeah.
So they'd done this procedure before where they took the cells, they send it to Oxford, and then they freeze the embryo, but they'd never done it fresh. So Zebby's cells were taken from the placenta on day five. He was kept out of the freezer, so he was kept fresh. And they did the cell analysis in 24 hours. And on day six, they rang me and said, you have one embryo here that is perfect. Come straight in and we'll put it in. And in he went. And I bled all the way through. And I kept thinking I was going to have a miscarriage.
You enjoy your pregnancy. I was, but also, were you cross at the fact that this was something that you were so longing for? You were pregnant, you were going up in weeks and, you know, going past what you'd miscarried before.
Yes.
Were you upset that actually you then never really got to enjoy being pregnant because you were constantly in a state of complete fear?
I don't think I thought about it like that at that time. I think a lot of stuff like that comes afterwards because, as I say, I was so focused on getting the baby. But I don't know, like then afterwards I've had feelings like, God, I never got to make love and make a baby in that way, and that's a thing that I will never have. But then
you made your baby through love.
Yeah, it's
making love's underrated.
It's
overrated.
Oh, God, it's underrated. It's
underrated and overrated. Wow. But you made your baby through love, but just a different, you know, a harder kind of love.
Yeah, really.
I mean, you worked, you know, it wasn't easy.
No.
Having a shag is easy.
Yeah, it is.
What you went through is unbelievable love.
My mother,
what you and Matt went through.
I don't know if this is interesting or not.
Yeah, put it in.
My mother and father, their first ever baby was a stillborn, which is very sad and a terrible experience to go through. And consequently, she had cesareans. But back in those days, it was a general anaesthetic to get the baby out. And so she never had that experience of that I did have with Matt, where you're there awake for the birth, even though it was a cesarean, and you get to meet your baby together. And she was just so grateful she had babies, and she never thought about it. And 40 years on, she was watching a film and somebody gave birth, and there was the joy of the mummy and daddy standing together holding the baby. And she sat and sobbed in the cinema for like about 2 hours.
Oh, no.
And she said it wasn't about the baby, it was that I'd never had that experience with my husband of meeting our child together.
Yeah.
So it's just, so I guess, different things that you just think you're entitled to in life, and actually you're entitled to none of it. And
sort of like when a friend was talking about and they had their baby and she had a really, really long labour and she was in such shock when the baby was born of what she'd just gone through.
Yeah.
That she just wasn't processing. She was just so shocked about how hard it was.
Yeah.
That she just couldn't. She said, I couldn't really hold the baby, look at the baby, be around the baby for a few hours because she just couldn't. Her body her mind was so all over the place.
Yeah.
And then she carried for so long this guilt of going, oh, yeah, God, you know. And it's hard. Like you have, like with parenting, you have this image and this expectation of how you think it's meant to be, and it's meant to be by the book, and it's all meant to be wonderful. When it doesn't happen, the guilt that you carry,
yes,
and the pain that you carry is so strong. When actually not there's one no right person,
wrong.
No,
and that's
not
why
one
I say,
person,
you
the
know,
same thing.
Exactly.
You had Zebby and he was born and he was perfect and just beautiful and is perfect and beautiful. How quickly were you like, okay, great, I've got Zebby, but I'm absolutely, we're doing this again. I'm having another baby. We're going to have another baby.
The day I got back from the hospital, three days after I had him, I rang my doctor at the Lister and I said, I've had him. I've got him. He's absolutely amazing. I'm crazy in love. When can I do it again? And he said, you have 6 months on the nose. I'll have you back in this room. You can start.
And was Matt like, yeah, we're going to do another.
Yeah. It'd taken 4 years of hard slog. And he was like, you know, let's just get it done.
Yeah. Go quickly.
Yeah.
So 6 months after when Zebby was, you went back.
Yeah.
And were you going back to retake the medicine? To start
to take my medicine. My IVF
But were you going to get pregnant at 6 months? Not like,
I was going to start IVF.
Right.
So I went to him to start the drugs.
Yeah.
And get on with it.
Were you kind of going, got Zebby, bit of a rocky start, but have him, so maybe the next bit is going to be a little bit simpler?
Well, I thought it would be simple because we'd had chromosomal problem miscarriages and because I'd bled through Zebby and they had given me through Zebby steroids and these drips, IVIG drips that are, it's like if you've got an immunity problem where you expel pregnancies and they
yes,
can give you
which
these...
is, so I had, it's called, oh God, what is it called? I know what it's called because I think I had it too and I had to have an injection the minute that Rudy was born. If your bloods mix, so I
oh,
do if your bloods
that's
mix.
To do with, no, that's different. Isn't that what Orna had?
I can't remember.
That's a blood type.
Oh, yes, that is a blood type.
Yeah. No, this is if you've got blood cells.
Rhesus negative, that's what it's
called.
Yeah,
that's your blood type. No, this is, it's a new thing, or not that new, but it's a bit controversial. Like some people really don't believe in it and some people just do it anyway. The Lister weren't particularly at this point, they might be more into it now, but they weren't that into it. But because I was bleeding with Zebby, I saw a different doctor through the Taranisi. Mm. He's much more controversial. And he put me on these steroids and IVIG drips that basically, it's like a blood plasma that stops your immune cells. It's like you're allergic to foreign substances, you've got such a hyper immune system that they get a baby and they go, this is a foreign object, get rid, and they, get
yeah,
rid.
Just, yeah.
So this blood plasma is supposed to help that.
Okay.
So my point is, to hold Zebby in, I'd had him chromosomally analysed. I'd had steroids. I was taking these drips. I was taking Clexane injections in my tummy every day to thin the blood and all this stuff. And I thought, well, we've cracked it. I know how to have a baby.
I know how to keep them in. Yeah, it's not romantic. Safe, yeah.
But let's just inject myself with shitloads of progesterone and everything else.
And it will be okay.
And if we know chromosomally the baby's okay, there shouldn't be a reason to not work.
Yeah.
But I had all of those things done. And all the embryos were perfect that round, weirdly. They were all chromosomally perfect. I think I had two put in. Basically, I've had 11 embryo transfers in my life, so I can't remember the exact. But anyway, miscarried. Ridiculous.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome. Like, what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome. Like, what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I miscarried them, and there was no rhyme or reason. And I had some frozen ones as well. Maybe they came first. I can't remember, but I miscarried a lot of them, and one of them didn't even make me pregnant, whereas normally I was always pregnant from it.
Yeah.
But after Zebby, after three rounds and maybe four or five embryo transfers, I was like, this is ridiculous. And I actually was ill.
Yeah.
I was mentally not well. And it was having a really physical effect. I was shaking. I had nerve tingling. I had so many things. And I suddenly sort of thought, I can't keep doing this. I've got a baby. Mm. I'm going to kill, you know, this. I'm not going to be alive if I keep doing this to myself, because it's just not healthy. So I literally said, I've got to take a break. I need to go and have time with Zebby and Matt and just be together and have a nice time and not do IVF to my own body, basically. Mm. And then I met this amazing, amazing girl who I had gone to drama school with, but not seen since I was 18. She was a dancer, and she had had four children on her rug at home in her living room, very good at giving birth. And she said to me, I would love to carry a baby for you.
I mean, it's
like, absolutely extraordinary.
It really is.
That's amazing. And I was like,
and this was just over a cup of tea and chatting.
Yeah, well,
things through.
It was through a mutual friend. I was talking to the mutual friend saying, I don't think I can do it again.
Did at any point, sorry to stop you, but did at any point, did you go, I'm not going to have more children, I'm just going to have one? Or was it now just being like, I'm not doing this again,
I say, I'm going to stop. But what I said was, I'm going to stop IVF.
Mm.
And in fact, I don't think I necessarily said I'm going to stop IVF. I said I'm going to stop
For now.
I need a break because it's not working and it's making me ill and it's not fair on anyone in this situation. And I'm not getting the answers. And then over this cup of tea, this amazing sort of magical thing happened. And I had these embryos still in a freezer. And all I had to do was move them to a clinic that allowed a surrogate because the Lister wouldn't deal with the surrogacy. So we like motorbiked the embryos to a different clinic. And she was so lovely. And we met her husband and these four children. And we had to wait a bit because she was still breastfeeding her fourth baby.
And was everyone happy and comfortable? How was Matt feeling? How was her husband feeling?
Well, it was like the first meeting was a bit awkward and a bit nervy.
Yeah.
But actually very quickly was sweet and open. And we all talked about everything. But you're on your own in England.
Yeah.
You're making a contract on your own. So it's very, very tricky ground, really. And it was definitely based on her being an absolute socialist. She believed 100% in helping another person. And she had had a very easy time of making and having and birthing babies. And she heard my story and she went, I want to help. I'm in a position I can help.
It's just amazing.
And her husband was of the same mindset and they were just amazing. So it took a bit of time. You know, we had to get to know each other and have family times and all the kids played and everything. But then we went ahead with the process and lo and behold, she got pregnant the first time. It's absolutely amazing. And then I made her have so many scans. Anyway, got to the 12-week scan and they were like, it's perfect. It's all fine. And we made it public and it was really exciting and she was so excited. And it was great. And then we went for a 16-week scan to find out the gender. And we went to this place in Maidenhead, which was sort of halfway between our homes. And they had like, it was one of those lovely baby scanning places where they have a big screen and ribbons and balloons. And
oh my gosh.
It's quite sweet. It's a sweet. Anyway, her and her husband and four children came. Me, Zebby and Matt went. Marie and I went into the room on our own. But where they were watching was a big cinema screen. So they were going to put the scan onto the screen.
So they were in a separate room.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And they were going to show us all the organs and the gender. And we're all very excited. But the poor woman put the scan on and she froze. And I'd been having therapy because I had been so anxious about the whole process and everything that had happened before. And I'd been taught not to catastrophize and not to panic. So I could see this lady, her breathing changed, and then I saw a tear.
Oh God.
And I thought, she's probably crying because it's surrogacy and it's such a beautiful thing between me and Marie. And I was trying to talk myself down from catastrophizing, and then she's had to say, there's no heartbeat, the baby's dead. And it was too far gone for it to be, you know, not that a miscarriage is simple, but she had to give birth to this baby because it was too past the date. It was too big. And it was a little girl. And it was so shocking. I mean, it was so shocking. And that's the bit that actually doing surrogacy in this country is just, I mean, look, that is going to be traumatic wherever you are, but to have no
support
and to not know, like, it's my pain, but it was her pain and her body. And I was so...
And your family, both your family's pain.
Sick for her. Yeah. And then what then happened was so awful and so dark because... So I can't remember exactly what happened. I think we were sent to A&E. So Matt and her husband took all the children off for fish and chips, and Matt just said, you know, he's somewhere in High Wycombe having fish and chips with someone else's husband and a load of kids. It's so random, and, you know, trying to jolly on the children and eat fish and chips, and I'm sat in A&E with Marie, and Marie's going, I need to have another scan because I can't believe it. And I was like, I agree, I don't believe it. I don't, you know, just these women just not believing what's happening. And they eventually sent us home, and we had to, whatever it was, we had to go back to the hospital on the Monday morning. This was a Saturday, this. And she had to take a pill.
And go maybe into labor. She didn't.
Yeah, she had to take a pill to go into labour. So they gave her the pill. And as we turned up in the hospital, my mum came with us to drive us. And then she sat in a room because she didn't know Marie. So I was like, look, I need you to be there for me, but you can't infringe on her privacy. So my mum just came and sat in a corridor. I sat with Marie. Marie started bleeding. And at the beginning, I do remember sort of saying, I'm here for you and I want to support you, but I don't want to encroach in your privacy. You know, she had to have her knickers off and everything. She's sitting on a giant pad, bleeding out my dead. I mean, it's so dark. Anyway, then she says, it's coming, it's coming. And I like ring for a doctor or a nurse. And they come, they bring a commode. They say, you have to go to the toilet on a commode. So she's sitting on a commode and she goes, it's come out. The baby's come out. But she's stuck on the commode because it's got an umbilical cord. Anyway. By this point, all I can see is like a dead baby in a commode and poor Marie stuck to it. And I'm calling for help and they take ages and then they come. But I have turned up at the hospital thinking, this is a strange day. Like, I'm going to have to watch a lady I met when I was 18 give birth to a dead baby. This is so awful. But then what ensued was she had placental... What's it called? When you can't get
Yeah,
it.
I know.
It's stuck in the placenta.
It's distal. It begins with a D.
Okay. But it's when the placenta doesn't naturally come out.
Yeah.
But because she was, I don't know, it was so dark. She kept sort of birthing these blood clots and they'd come in and go, oh, that's the placenta. And then 10 minutes later, they'd come back and say, that wasn't the placenta.
And it's incredibly dangerous.
It's so dangerous. And they let her go for so many hours. And she was clutching hold of me. And this is a woman who was so good at birth and had only ever done home births. And she was so stoic and incredible. And she was literally scratching my skin off in agony, giving birth to blood clots. And I kept saying, and at one point my mum begged a doctor and said, there is a woman who out of the goodness of her soul has just had to give birth to a dead baby. Help her. Like, she's the mother. I honestly thought she was going to die and that I would be responsible for the death of a mother of four children. And no one was helping me and no one was helping her. And it was unbearable. Anyway, listen, the positive side is she's absolutely fine. They took her finally for a general anaesthetic, which she'd never had in her life. So she was scared and her husband was scared. But they then suctioned out the placenta but she'd lost so much blood. She was then in there for like 3 days having blood transfusions. And I mean, it was such a disastrous, awful.
Like, Tara, that is so beyond traumatic. It's actually like, I've actually never heard it in that, like that before. Don't know how you come back from that.
Well, and then, so after, poor thing, after she'd had her operation, she then said, and this was then also the really tricky bit about, you know, the baby bit, was they said, would you like to see the baby? And I thought, I don't think I do. And she said, I really want to see it. And then I thought, well, okay, then I should see it. It's actually my baby. I suppose I should see it. Anyway, then we saw, me and her sat around and this tiny dead baby was brought in like a little basket, but it was like a bread basket because it was so small. Oh, it was so awful. We sat there looking at it and I thought, what on earth am I doing?
But then also, like, I think that if you didn't see your baby,
I think you're right.
You would have gone, like, right. I should have seen my baby.
It was right, but it should have been me and Matt seeing the baby. It was just so weird.
I felt
because I was trying to be respectful of her all the time.
That you weren't acknowledging.
I felt like I was intruding something. Yeah, it was a weird feeling. Yeah. That's what it was.
It was your baby, but you were.
But I felt like I was letting it be her baby.
Yeah.
Because she'd just been through all this absolute horror.
What? Like,
so that's weird. Yeah, so that so yes, look, I don't think I was very well after that for a bit.
Did you have unbelievable support after, or did you not allow yourself to really realize what had just happened?
Listen, unbelievable support all the way through. I've never not had amazing support. My parents, Matthew, all my friends, incredible.
And were you still going, but my baby's out there?
Do you know, honestly, I think I was. But no, I think I had maybe 2 weeks where I said, we can't, that's it. We started maybe adoption process. So it was never, we're not going to have another baby. But I did think probably I'll never do surrogacy again. Certainly for a bit, I thought that. Then Marie said, I want to do it again. And I was like, don't be ridiculous. I've nearly killed you. And she said, I can't bear not doing it. I want to do it.
Oh, Marie.
And I said, I'm not using my eggs anymore. That's what happened at the end of that. I said, I don't want... It had been, I didn't want to use my body because I thought that's why I kept miscarrying. And then I thought, this is so complicated. No one's explaining what's going on, but what seemingly is a perfectly good egg in a perfectly good womb, or my womb and my... It's just not working. I want to take me out of the equation and have a baby either through adoption or through surrogacy and egg donation. But I don't want it to be biologically connected to me because that seems to not be working.
Which is another unbelievably big decision.
Big decision, yeah.
And did you, you know, how was Matt when you turned to Matt and be like, we're still going and I still want our baby.
Yeah.
But I now don't want to be biologically...
Part of it.
Was he frightened?
What was he like? I think he just kept... Honestly, I don't think at any point he ever stopped me doing anything. I think he was... Only until we'd had Beau, then he stopped me.
Yeah. We'll get to that. We'll get to that.
Yeah. I think he was...
He wanted you
if
to have...
If I had said at any point, we are so lucky to have Zebby... Please, let's just be a really happy family of three. He would have said okay. But he did want another child. Mm. So he was happy.
To
as long
going,
as I was pushing it forward. Yeah.
So Marie cannot carry. Can't be the surrogate of, in England, she can't be the surrogate of a baby that isn't biologically yours. You have to, it's not legal
no,
in England.
No.
Or she can.
She can. She could be, you either get traditional surrogacy or... I can't remember what the other one's called. But anyway.
Yeah.
The other one is the one where it's my egg and her body.
Yeah.
Traditional surrogacy is that you get a turkey baster.
Right.
With Matt's sperm and you pop it up when she's ovulating. So she's actually
she's
egg donor and the surrogate.
I see.
Yeah. So we were going to try that. And we did try that a few times. But that was fun.
It's disgusting.
I used to get Matt's sperm in a pot. You bought these sterile pots. You can buy it all online. And then because...
Matt did so much wanking.
He's an international wanker. Because
yeah.
Then he had to go to America and wank there. But we wanted the sperm to be as fresh as possible. And we lived 50 minutes apart. And the middle ground was Beaconsfield Services. So I used to turn up. Matt would do his wank. I'd take
in Beaconsfield.
No,
services.
He did okay, wank at home. Say. Yeah, that's a bit too much to
just
ask.
Really,
yeah.
Just give me a minute.
Get me a Mac.
Yeah, yeah.
I would then drive the sperm to Beaconsfield Services, meet Marie, and she would go into the toilets. I'd take her little baby.
Oh my god!
And like take her for a little cake.
But what? And then she put her legs in the air and
yeah,
hope for the
toilets.
Best.
Well, you know, I'd give her the
like
sperm and like a pipette, yeah, and she'd go
like
off
inserting
and...
a tampon.
Yeah,
my God, Tara,
I know.
So you tried this a few times,
and funnily enough, it didn't work.
Weird.
Maybe it was
so
the
weird. I think it was the pipette because you said you were using a turkey baster, and I'm pretty sure that shouldn't have been. Okay.
Is any of this right?
This
no.
is. Oh my God. So you're still, I just think this is one of the most important stories. And you're still going, and now you realize that, okay, the turkey baster isn't going to work. So we're going to America.
Going to America. I met these guys, and they've got this agency in Chicago. And I met the guy who runs it from England. Guy called Brett, married to a guy called Matt, which is funny because that's my brother and my husband.
So nice.
Lovely chaps. And they have this beautiful son called Sebastian through surrogacy. And he took me through the whole process, and I was sold, because then basically in America, it's just a different story because it's legalized.
Yeah.
So obviously you are still going through all the absolute same emotions, but it is taken care, all the kind of practical side and the hospital side and all of the kind of actually to take care of, they take care of the surrogate and you can have an emotional relationship with her. And we went and met ours. We had this amazing lady called Chris in Utah, and we went to Utah for the 20-week scan, and we went obviously for the birth and everything. We spent quite a lot of time with her, and I think you can choose to have as much of a relationship as you wish to have. It doesn't have to be that involved.
Yeah,
but we're probably a bit more comfortable doing it like that. But you know, the time she didn't get pregnant, I didn't have to be so involved, and I didn't, so it was just handled. And
did you pick your egg in America?
Oh yes. So the egg donor is brilliant. That's like you just go on all these American websites. It's not like England, and it's like a dating app.
And were you okay? Did you find this kind of, was there any point where you sort of went, oh, I feel a bit wobbly about this? Or was there a point where Matt went, I feel a bit wobbly about this?
I felt really wobbly about the egg donation thing quite a lot when we were first looking. I remember sincerely sort of going, God, you know, you spend your life, or hopefully not our daughter's generation, but yeah, I spent my life not loving what I saw in the mirror. And now I'm looking at all these sort of very beautiful egg donors and thinking, but they're not me. And that's such a weird feeling. Like, why do you want it to be you when you've not necessarily loved yourself? Or
it's
such a mind game. Yeah, yeah, that we do so intrinsically want to procreate our own. Anyway, so I did find it hard at the beginning, and Matt found it quite hard, and we spent a few hours, and I found it a bit depressing. And then I said to Matt, do you know what, you choose an appropriate egg donor, the one that most looks like me or most feels right for our family. And that's what he did. He got it down to three. And then we were with his mum, my mum, and me. And he showed us the three. And all of us were, well, I didn't so much, but the two mums went, oh, it's that one.
Yeah.
Immediately, it's that one. And she's this beautiful doctor in America with curly hair like mine and a big white teethy smile like mine. And she's actually mixed race, Cuban, Jamaican, and so she's got very olivey skin like mine, and it seemed absolutely right. And that was that. Anyway, I say all of that felt so important then, and none of it feels important now. And that's how it goes, isn't it?
Absolutely. So your surrogate in America had then this egg and Matt's sperm put inside of her.
Yeah.
And she got pregnant.
Yeah, second time. So we had the same process as we'd had with Zebby with the chromosomes, because they just do that in America.
Yeah.
So we had, and also they tell you the gender, because that's not illegal either.
Yeah.
Not that we chose, but they just tell you.
Yeah.
So out of all these amazing eggs this girl got, we only had three embryos that were chromosomally fine. And he said, right, you've got girl, girl, boy. And I would use them in that order. That's how they look. They're all perfect, but this girl looks the best. This girl looks second best. This boy looks third best. So the first girl didn't work, then Bo did work, and we had Bo. And then, you know, we had this.
You had Bo.
We had Bo.
Yeah. Which was kind of this
extraordinary
thing of, I remember we all had drinks the night before you left. Because you went to labor early. No, you know what I was thinking about, having the drinks the night before we went to labor with Zebby, when you had Zebby. But Bo.
Oh, yeah.
It was crazy because we were waiting for this baby that we weren't seeing. It wasn't like we saw you with a bump or we saw someone else with a bump. This growing baby was in Utah. And you and Matt had your date where you were going to go out. she went into labor early.
Yeah.
So if I am correct, you then got the phone call. You and Sebi and your mum all got on an airplane straight away to catch the birth, to catch Beau. Matt came a day later and you got there and you arrived in time and you witnessed your amazing daughter being born.
Yeah. I got to the hospital 41 minutes before she came out.
That's meant to be.
Because she was waiting for
me. She was waiting for her mummy.
She's
so nice.
She's really nice.
And you had Beau.
Yeah.
And with this anticipation, and obviously I think you're like, you sort of touched upon your worry of what it would feel like having your baby this way. And, you know, I can imagine if you fear the connection. And she was amazing and she wanted you immediately.
She did.
Which is she just did. Kind
she,
of.
I held her. I mean, she went on my chest straight away. But after half an hour, I went and put her on Chris and I was like, look what you've done. She's so perfect. You're so amazing. And then I went to speak to the doctor and Chris said, oh my God, look, as soon as I moved my voice to talk to the doctor, the baby followed my voice. Oh, she really liked me.
She really liked
me. I know. I really liked her and it was so sweet.
And Matt came out the next day.
He actually came like 3 days later.
Yeah.
Because you have to be in hospital in America for 3 days.
Yeah.
So I had my room with Beau and Chris was in the room next door.
Yeah.
And we'd go in and out of each other's room. And it was all very sweet. And then they wheelchaired me out of the hospital and I kept saying, I haven't given birth. And they were like, it's protocol.
Talk to me about Matt meeting Beau.
Oh, so then where we were staying, we had a house, but it wasn't ready yet. Because we had to be there for about a month. So we were in the Best Western, Layton, Utah. That was Beau's first home.
Sounds beautiful.
It was beautiful. And my mum, Zebby and I had a room and Beau. And Matt was arriving. But we only had one room is the point because it was packed for some kind of conference.
Yeah.
So we had this big double bed that we all slept in. And then my mum had a mattress on the floor. And Zebby just fell asleep. And Matt texting, I'm pulling into the hotel now in the taxi. And my mum said, go outside into the corridor so you can have your moment with Matt of introducing him to Beau. And I hadn't cried yet in that sort of happy, over-emotional baby way. I'd sort of been keeping it all together. And I actually thought, oh my God, I'm about to go and present Matthew, his daughter. Like, this is so over-emotional. And he got to the corridor and he looked at her and he looked, you know, sort of impressed. Took the baby in his arms and then he locked eyes with me and he said, we are done now. Please promise me this is it. We can't have any more. And I was like, oh, stop ruining it.
What I find is just so heartbreaking about that is that his strength that he's carried you through these two babies, which were just so hard to get. And then there she was and he went, I can't go on. Like now telling you like we're done. Like,
yeah.
No more now. Perfect. No more.
Yeah.
Enough. What's that film? Enough now. Enough. What is that film?
I don't know. Oh,
God damn it.
But I really like it.
Enough now. Enough. And before we wrap up the podcast, which I've only learned a few days ago, is that your third embryo, the boy, you then obviously from going enough now, enough.
Yes.
You did something, is it right? You called adopt the
embryo? Yeah, embryo adoption.
So your third embryo went to someone else.
Yes.
Who so was he could, their baby.
Either it hasn't worked, but I don't like to think that.
Yeah.
He's in the world and he's made another family a happy family.
Which is such
isn't that nice
a beautiful
to think?
Way to round up,
yeah.
I think, your story. Tara, I think it is so unbelievable what you've gone through and to know you and to witnessed it all, but you know it was a process of years and years, but to hear it all in just an hour, it's kind of your bravery and your complete knowledge in knowing that you were going to get your family no matter how they came to you, you were going to find them and get them, and you did.
Yeah.
And you now have these two incredible children who were so loved And now very naughty, aren't they?
Yeah, really naughty, obnoxious.
And I just think you're just amazing what you've gone through and are going through. And I know that it's probably a process that, you know, takes a while to kind of sink in.
Thanks, Mummy. Thanks for having me.
Oh, wait, I need to ask the last question.
Sorry.
To round it up, what is the one bit of advice that you will give, that you would have given your non-parenting self? So before you became a parent, if you knew yourself then, what would you say to that person?
Oh, God.
I never, by the way,
I know,
answer that. Right? Just can't do it. Just literally not one podcast has that gone smoothly. But I love the fact that everyone now knows it doesn't go smoothly.
I don't know the answer to it either, Matilda.
You don't need to have an answer.
I think, okay, maybe what I would say is, don't ever read a book.
Mm.
Don't ever read a book and have any expectation of what they should be doing or could be doing, or just let them be.
I agree. I think
is that a fair thing
I think
to
that's
say?
Unbelievable, lovely advice and completely true. Like Emma Freud said, just muddle through.
Yeah. Let them sleep when they want to sleep. Mm-hmm. Just let them do what they want to do.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Don't put yourself under pressure.
No.
Or Tara.
And also that they come out who they are.
Yes, we were talking about this. Who was I talking about? I think we were talking about it, just how they come out just a complete individual.
Yeah.
And that always takes you by surprise.
Yeah.
Because you think they're going to come out
exactly
how you are and how you feel. And you're like,
this is a bit unrecognizable.
No,
what's
wait,
going on?
Yeah. They're different. They're a different person to me. I really hope that this is insightful and this helps people who are going through what you've gone through and fertility issues. And it's such a miracle to be pregnant.
It really is.
And it is amazing hearing people's stories of how they came to be parents.
I know.
And how we, you know, like I've always said, you know, how we always put pressure on ourselves, but how it all works out for the best. Thank you so much, Tara Carr.
Thanks, Mama Matilda.
I love you.
I love you too.
Thank you everyone for listening to Bringing Up Us, and see you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.